The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Champions League, midweek action featuring Chelsea, Man United and more. The games in the Premier League as well. Defeat at Turf Moor for Spurs and what it means for Burnley. We'll look ahead to the League Cup final, Liverpool against Chelsea, and get fresh drama from the Inter Totally Cup. It's all coming up in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Good morning, listener. Yeah, there we were cheering them on and delighting with them only a few months ago at the Euros, and thoughts with them now as they face really these darkest of days. It's February 24th, Totally Football Show, and with us today we've got Duncan Alexander of Opta. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Carl Anker of The Athletic. Hello, Carl.
Hello there.
I'm Rory Smith of The New York Times. Rory, difficult times to be writing about football.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem to matter particularly. I've been away for a month, having had a little girl, and the first thing I've got to write is a column on how football finds itself kind of front and centre in these moments where it really doesn't matter at all, and whether that's talking about moving the Champions League final from St. Petersburg, the fact that Gazprom, which is a company that is seen in a lot of cases as a kind of soft power arm of the Russian state, whether it's Chelsea and Everton, both of whom have oligarchs who've been named in parliament as backers in one shape or form, oligarchs who could face sanctions if that's what the British government decides to do. And I think it's difficult because I was struck earlier in the week by the sort of hoo-ha over what UEFA would do, and it seemed at one point there was more pressure on UEFA than there was on like NATO or the UN. And in one sense, that's really unfair because UEFA obviously is just an organisation that organises football matches. It really isn't like a major diplomatic power. But in the other, I think it is part of this thing that we talk about a lot, which is football's pursuit of money and influence and power has led it down a path where it is susceptible and vulnerable to these sorts of situations. So this thing that's happened overnight in Ukraine does have, weirdly, it's not the most important kind of aspect of it, and it's, in a way, it feels glib to talk about it, but it does have an impact on football, and that is football's fault for not safeguarding itself from outside influences enough. And I think at times like these it is worth just pausing briefly and thinking about the position football's put itself in by opening its doors to whoever has enough money to buy it.
Right, no, very, very good point. Congratulations, by the way. On the addition to your family. Well, desperate times for the people of Ukraine, and our best wishes that things get resolved as quickly as they can be. The football then. Three Premier League games midweek with big wins for Liverpool, Palace and Burnley. Four Champions League ties. Chelsea the only winners in these, beating Lille 2-0. Everybody else drew. Villarreal 1-1 with Juventus. Villarreal coming from behind after Dusan Vlahovic scored a whole 33 seconds into that game. Benfica holding Ajax 2-2 with Sebastian Haller scoring at both ends. And Man United in that 1-1 draw at Atletico Madrid, which of course is where we're going to begin.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Fred with a nice ball into Bruno Fernandes. Elanga was on the run. Elanga might be in. Chance for Manchester United. Oh, he scored! What a moment for Anthony Elanga! And the teenager comes up big time in the Champions League. Atletico Madrid 1, Manchester United 1.
Daniel Sturri calls this their worst performance, Man United, under Ralf Rangnick, but also one of their best results. Is that right? And does the result excuse how bad they were for, what, an hour or so? I'm guessing Carl's got something to say here. Carl?
That goal butters a number of parsnips, I'd say. It was a terrible, terrible first half for Manchester United. They were manhandled, outclassed. They seemed almost shocked and offended by the concept that Atletico Madrid would dare to press them. So Ralf Rangnick went for Victor Lindelof at right back and tried United to progress the ball in a sort of 3-1-6 formation with Fred as the single pivot and Pogba and Bruno Fernandes with Bomon. And Atletico Madrid were essentially content to let the three-man defence of Rafael Varane, Harry Maguire and Victor Lindelof have the ball. But any time the ball went wide or progressed a little bit further than Fred, any time there was a crossfield ball from Harry Maguire, they pressed with, I wouldn't even say huge amounts of aggression, you know, just what you'd expect from a top team that has won a La Liga title or a team that is hoping to win top titles. And Manchester United completely were discombobulated by this. Yao Felix and Carrera were frequently dropping into space next to Fred anytime the ball was trying to be progressed, and Fred was essentially swamped. He was just shocked by the fact that neither Paul Pogba or Bruno Fernandes was holding back and trying to help him out. There was one moment early, well, I'd say halfway through the first half, where Fred looked at Harry Maguire in possession and basically said, H, on the ground, on the ground. Mm. Just played the short five-yard pass to where Maguire panicked, played a direct pass very much into a pressing trap from Atletico Madrid. United had, I think I've been on this podcast before and lamented at the lack of a proper defensive midfielder. I also now want to lament the fact they don't really have a serious someone to tell everyone to just calm the F down and play some five-yard passes. And
So that was United getting discombobulated. What combobulated them back again?
Substitutions, strangely enough. I believe Ralf Rangnick said after the game that his halftime team talk was essentially, remember your processes. You've completely thrown all your processes out the window. And while his initial batch of substitutions, Nemanja Matic, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, Alex Telles looked defensive in terms of personnel, what it actually created was more of a sustained presence in central midfield. So this sort of U-shape in build-up that United played, where they ceded the space in central midfield, stopped as Nemanja Matic formed a more solid defensive platform with Fred, which allowed Bruno Fernandes to be a little bit more secure and played a pass to Antony Elanga.
Elanga. All right. So now that I'm having to learn his song, who am I singing about exactly?
You are singing about the 19-year-old Swedish international Antony Elanga, who was born 10 years after Rhythm is a Dancer. But it's a great ditty. It's a great ditty. A great fan chant. I quite enjoy it.
He's got quite a remarkable record of late, he said, running that one out again. Coming off the bench to score late on for United in Madrid, just as he did at Elland Road on Sunday. A lovely, cool finish. The obligatory questions about Jan Oblak's positioning. Duncan, was it United's worst performance under Rangnick? What do the numbers say?
Well, they didn't have a touch in the opposition penalty box until the 55th minute, which for me is against a non-vintage Atletico team is not ideal. As Carl said, the first half they just looked scared. I mean, I know the atmosphere was good, but this is Manchester United. Their players should be able to handle that. But yeah, the last 20 minutes they got on top, and I think probably have got a blueprint for the second leg there. You'd imagine Elanga might start as well. I mean, Rangnick came out at the end and said, Elanga plays with joy and I wish some other players would look at him as an example. And it's like, wonder which gesticulating icon he might be referencing there. But yeah, I think it's funny. With a lot of these games this week in the Champions League, as you said at the start, three of them ended in draws. Now, in previous years, there'd have been quite a lot of jeopardy, but basically, it's like a sort of Rumbelow's Cup now, isn't it? Where it's just a draw. There's another 90/120 minutes to go. A lot of that mystique and potential drama from the away goals rule has gone. And I think a lot of those teams will be happy almost turning it into a straight, one-off game in the second leg.
Well, we'll see. We'll see about that. We should salute the imposter João Felix and his magnificent header to open the scoring for Atletico Madrid. I do get... So Roy Keane said that. When did Roy Keane say that about?
He said that during the Euros, I believe.
Oh, did he?
Was
okay.
When Portugal were on their way out of the tournament and Roy Keane decried João Felix as an imposter.
I mean, again, if you look at the numbers, it's the numbers of what he costs and the numbers of what he's produced. You can see how people might feel that he hasn't lived up to the billing. But I think one of the issues would be the manager and the way that the manager that he works for, how he plays his football. Lovely goal, though. Sorry, Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, we did a piece on the analysts earlier in the month. João Félix, for someone of his, you know, stature and ability and playing style, he gets far, far fewer opportunities in games, usually, than equivalent players at other teams. So it's almost like the pressure's on him to do more when he gets the ball, because he won't get the number of touches a Messi or a Neymar will. So, you know, if you can start scoring diving headers like Keith Houchin in his pomp, then fair play, that's a good thing to add.
Who is that?
Keith Houchin.
Charles,
87 FA Cup final.
Oh, okay.
That is an iconic goal. I think a painter and decorator near where I live, whose van I see quite often, who was called Keith Houchin. And every time I see the van, it makes me think, I wonder if that is the Keith Houchin. If he is,
I wonder
now
if his
like
finish
a,
is every like bit a, as good as, yeah.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Whether he's sort of, does that, is someone of Keith Houchin's generation, it is feasible he went on to become a patron decorator in North Yorkshire. That is not, absolutely, that's not impossible. João Félix was a really weird signing for two reasons when Atletico bought him. One was the price, which was nuts. And there's no, you can't really debate the fact they overpaid for him. That's just, Atleti got a little bit done by Benfica / the agents on the price. And the other is that it was never really apparent where he was going to fit into a Simeone team. And I think it's not his fault, but the last couple of years, one of the issues with Atleti, as they've tried to evolve into something different, is that it doesn't look like Simeone really wants to do it. There's part of him thinking, I've got to do this. I think he recognises the need to do it, but I'm not sure he, like, deep in his cholo soul, really thinks, this is something I desperately want to do. I want to have, like, a elfin creative Portuguese midfielder as a number 10. And even if you looked at the bench last night when they were starting to lose control, and I don't know, I think it's fair to say United were awful for an hour, but they were also quite good for the last half an hour, and a football match does last 90 minutes. So even, you know, if you start badly and you are then a bit better, that should be kind of factored in. But you looked at the bench and you thought, they've got Suarez and Griezmann, and, you know, Thomas Lemar was on the bench. They were missing Carrasco, who I think has been Atleti's best player this year. Certainly in big games, he's the one bit of pace they've got. I'm not sure Simeone really... They're not really Simeone players, any of them. Like, I'm not sure he's that bothered by... I think Suarez would have been like 5 years ago, but like an essentially static Luis Suarez is not what a Simeone team needs. Griezmann's a bit... And I realise he came from Atleti, but Griezmann's a bit sort of starry now. He's a little bit Galactico. That doesn't really fit into the model. There's a weirdness to Atletico. And I think eventually, United, who have exactly the same problem, kind of worked that out and found a way through. Although that said, they scored the goal because Renan Lodi fell over. That shouldn't be underestimated.
Well, the pace of the pass made him fall over, surely.
I mean, maybe. Fall over a lot on football pitches, so I can't... There's lots of reasons you fall over on a football pitch, but I'm pretty sure if he doesn't fall over, they don't score.
1-1 then. Atleti also hitting the bar twice in the game. Who do you like for the second leg? Who have you got?
I think this is United to lose. I mean, if they don't get discombobulated in that 45 minutes, they should hopefully carry out their task and defeat Atletico Madrid. I think what's also interesting now for United is their best front three includes Jadon Sancho and Anthony Elanga on current form, which means Daniel Story has often talked about how United have reached the critical mass of attacking talent where there's always at least one very good player that's going to be sat on the bench. I think we've reached the point now where Marcus Rashford will probably have to sit on the bench for these big games, because Elanga is far more diligent in his defensive work and he's a lot more attuned to running in behind in a way that Rashford used to be but isn't at this current point in time.
I think Rangnick really likes Elanga. There's an interesting like dynamic around Elanga, which is that he is the sort of player that Manchester United, if they want to play the sort of football that Pochettino plays or that Erik ten Hag plays, that kind of Jadon pressing, intense, dynamic style that is now the way that all of the elite teams in Europe play, then you need players like Anthony Elanga. The question with United is always, if you start the 19-year-old Swedish kid, you have to leave out now not just one, but two pretty big stars. And that's going to be a real challenge. It's kind of the problem Man United face in microcosm.
All right. Oh, one other thing before we move on. I think we were probably all shocked when Man United took the knee before the game began, and the crowd at the Wanda Metropolitano largely whistled this. And the first reaction is, why would you whistle that? But people have pointed out that it's an unfortunate illustration of the fact that, to some extent, progress has been made, because it is a surprise to us now in this country, that because people don't do that anymore, whereas, you know, a year ago, they were regarding that gesture as being somehow offensive.
It's a curious one, in that when I watch Champions League games between two non-English sides, I do have a little knee-jerk moment. Oh yeah, they don't take the knee anymore, which, you know, shows the strength of the knee and why it does work, because it has essentially normalized a little bit of anti-racism rhetoric into the footballing space, and it was much needed. In terms of the jeers, I am choosing to not be exhausted by it. Any individual who takes the knee or understands why the knee is important also understands that at some point in time, taking the knee will involve or see you encounter some form of dissent and disruption. So, yeah, if they want to whistle, fine. But I hope Manchester United players and other players of Premier League persuasion continue to do so.
Indeed. All right, let's hit the other Champions League midweek games after this.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporters Support Line, and ahead of the League Cup final, we're speaking to Liverpool fan Chris.
Yeah, I've been saying since the start of the season, you know, that the one that we really want to win this season is the League Cup.
Yeah, what was that? The League
Cup, yeah.
The League Cup might not be top of everyone's trophy wish lists, but Paddy Power are offering a free £5 bet builder on the final this weekend. Paddy Power.
Selected online bets only. Min 2 plus legs. Max 1 free £5 bet per customer. Must have previously deposited to avail. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
All right, the 1-1 draw at the Wanda Metropolitana stylistically had some parallels, I would say, Rory Smith, with that Juventus performance at Villarreal, which objectively was more awful by most metrics. They took the lead earlier. What was that, 33 seconds? Dusan Vlahovic scoring on his Champions League debut, then utterly abandoned any attacking intent whatsoever. It was very much like watching Giovanni Trapattoni's Juventus, or indeed Giovanni Trapattoni's any team.
It was very like stereotypically Italian in a way that isn't really true anymore, because that's not how most Italian teams played. But Juve decided to kind of... The cliche thing to say is the early goal didn't do them any favours, because it then gave them something to sit back and protect. Although, as Duncan points out, the thing they had to sit back and protect isn't nearly as valuable as it used to be, so you shouldn't really sit back and protect it.
Also, I've been watching Dusan Vlahovic since he joined Juve, and obviously before, but particularly the excitement that his debut in Serie A brought with another early goal and a brilliantly taken one much like this has just kind of dissipated as he's got kind of lost in this kind of ongoing allegrismo that we're having, which is very un-allegro. I fear that he might become a bit of a João Félix figure, a tremendous talent that's utterly underused.
There seems to be a lot of pressure on his shoulders to transform an entire club single-handedly, which is never really an ideal situation for a player who's still quite young, and who, as I think James Horncastle pointed out earlier this week, like he'd never played in the Champions League. That for all that he's held up in the same breath as Mbappe and Haaland, he hasn't proved himself on that level yet at all. He's not had the chances. He's been playing for Fiorentina. I'm not sure that strike force, even with Dybala there, necessarily looks to me like a sufficiently like balanced team to go far in the Champions League. Although it should be pointed out, Juve did come away from Villarreal with a positive result and would be favourites to go through. And if they get a relatively kind draw in the quarters you know, it's not impossible that they might end up in the semi-finals of the Champions League, which is a pretty good return for a very flawed team.
Well, that's true. I don't think the strike force is so much the issue, though. I think, without getting in-depth on Juve, I think it's more the midfield, which leaves the strike force utterly unserviced. And part of the issue there is that, possibly because they needed to find the money for Vlahovic, they sold off two, well, one particularly key asset in Bentancur, and another one who would have been quite useful, Kulusevski, in the same January transfer window. So very much, you know, a short blank kit, either not covering your feet or the upper reaches of your body situation, perhaps. Oh, sorry, Rory.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, in some ways it is admirable that they decided to construct a strike force that looked like it is exclusively made up of 1950s counterfeit cigarette salesmen in Morata and Vlahovic, both of whom have a real kind of fate ration book air to them in the way they look.
Gary That's not Sparrow. Meant to be.
There's something a little bit a little bit Boycey about both of them, if I'm completely honest. One for the. I mean, if Carl's not heard of Keith Houchen, he's probably not heard of Boycey.
I'm taking your point about Morata on that, but for me, Vlahovic looks like a Jacob Rees-Mogg is a sporting cousin.
Yeah, that's
check
not
him
a
out
shout,
next
actually,
time
yeah,
you see
yeah,
him.
Yeah.
Dybala, meanwhile, is a ringer for Eren out of Attack on Titan.
Oh, I don't know that reference.
I didn't have you down as an Attack on Titan fan.
I've been introduced to it, and it's. It's bonkers, yeah.
It's very good shonen.
Is this a television anyway, program? This is like the opposite of the Keith Houchen thing.
It is an anime, my friend.
No, I was going to say that there's clearly an issue with the midfield. Like Juve are not a balanced team. They're not a particularly good team. Their Serie A form kind of shows that. But they will look at a couple of teams coming through, including Manchester United, and think, you know, if we get them and not a Bayern or a Liverpool or a Manchester City, then we stand a chance of making the final four.
What about a Benfica or an Ajax after their match, built on history, as it was, on Wednesday? 2-2, it finished. Did it live up to that utterly magnificent little film that that Ajax put out to celebrate
Almost.
The fixture?
It seemed quite nice, considering how good that video was, that the game ended in the draw. My housemate partner is an Ajax fan, watched the game very much behind me and was making loads of frantic noises and shouting and screaming at Sebastian Haller, who scored an own goal and then scored a goal in the space of, I think, 4 minutes. Their post-match debrief was very much of the moment Ajax assumed ascendancy, they simply forgot how to play quote-unquote Ajax football in the second half. So again, it seems to be... I've always said I miss away goals and I think they're fantastic. But it does seem as if the lack of jeopardy that away goals provided has created a sort of complacency to some of these Champions League first legs. I would not have believed Ajax to have ended that game 2-2 if away goals were still a thing.
Well, they conceded more goals in that game than they did in their previous 10 in all competitions. So,
wow.
Yeah, but... I mean, Haller, his season is going to go down as one of the great. I mean, I hope he can maintain it, but it feels like it's going to go down as one of those great statistical quirks. He scored as many goals in 7 Champions League games as Michael Owen did in 6 Champions League seasons, which is pretty impressive.
Excellent. Well, Chelsea, meanwhile, were also in action. That was Tuesday night with a 2-0 victory over Lille. Goals here from Kai Havertz and Christian Pulisic, but not from Romelu Lukaku, who was dropped to the bench. Chelsea are the first English team in the history of the European Cup or Champions League to win 5 consecutive home matches without conceding a goal. So that's good. Lukaku, does look like there's only one way this is going between him and Thomas Tuchel.
Sounds like a long 2-year loan to somewhere else, as Chelsea inevitably go, we probably shouldn't have sold Tammy Abraham.
But it's weird, isn't it? It's a weird situation because Lukaku is a brilliant player. We know Lukaku is a brilliant player. We've seen that Lukaku is a brilliant player. And Tuchel is a brilliant manager. He won the Champions League in 6 months. It was probably the greatest like one-off managerial feat of recent times to turn that Chelsea team, the one that he encountered, into European champions overnight. And Chelsea are a really well-run club. Like they're considered broadly best in class in terms of how they scout, how they recruit, how they spend their money. They obviously have a lot of money because they've got a Russian backer, but they spend it well. It's hard to they're not the kind of 2005, 2006 Chelsea who just sort of frittered money away on the off chance that this random collection of big names would work. That's a mantle they've passed to Manchester United. And yet they spent 90 million quid on Romelu Lukaku, who's a player they know really well because they used to employ him. Mm. And yet they don't really seem to have brought him in and thought, right, how are we going to get him? What does he add to this system and how do we get that out of him? Tuchel is asking him to do something that doesn't really suit him. We saw at Inter that he kind of works well with a partner, that he wants to be involved in the game, that he's not a target man in that sense. And yet they've not really tweaked the way they play to accentuate that. They've been like, well, you can stand there, Romelu, and be Romelu Lukaku, and you'll score loads of goals. The whole thing is a bit weird.
Yeah, I looked at something on Lukaku earlier this week, obviously with the seven touches for Roure, and in his 17 times in Premier League history, he's had 50 or more touches in a game, and they were all at Everton. And I think people would broadly agree his best spell in the Premier League was when he was playing at Everton, and managers Martinez, Koeman got the best out of him because they didn't use him like Chelsea using him. They used him like Inter used him, and lo and behold, he played much better. So I think, it, like Rory says, it's baffling that it's not that hard to work out, and yet they don't seem to be doing it.
It does seem to me that when your manager says it's not the time to laugh about him and make jokes about him and he's mentally tired, that you're probably... You're at your Mourinho miming a golf swing stage of the relationship.
But that's also quite a strange thing for a manager to say. It's like it's the old don't imagine an elephant sort of thing. It's like if you say don't make a joke about my striker...
No, absolutely,
then,
yeah.
The other problem, just touching on what Carl said, and it's not like this story hasn't been covered before, the other issue Chelsea have got is I'm not sure who can pay his wages. I think I saw after the Sky Italia interview sort of a suggestion that he wants to go back to Inter. Good luck with that, Romelu. They can't pay you. So you kind of think, well, are Chelsea going to be stuck with him or stuck paying him to play for somebody else? The whole thing is weird.
All right. Chelsea fans are saying, hang on a second. We're now 2-0 up in the first leg of our last 16 clash with Lille. Thomas Tuchel, our manager, progressed through or won 73% of all his Champions League knockout ties ever as a manager. That's extraordinary. Let's have some positivity. Well, let's then, as we look ahead to the big cup game that Chelsea have got this weekend. It's the Carabao Cup final. Woohoo! And it's Pitt's Chelsea against Liverpool. Carl, it's only their second meeting in the League Cup final ever. I'm not sure if will you remember the first, perhaps? It's 2005. Jose Mourinho is in charge of Chelsea in his coach.
That was very fun.
And it was a game that was going Liverpool's way until a remarkable own goal from one Steven Gerrard.
Oh, the kick has gone in! It's an own goal! Steven Gerrard, the Liverpool captain, sees it flick in. Remarkably, Chelsea have got their equaliser from a most unlikely source.
Stevie OG.
Stevie OG. Crikey. That's almost as disrespectful as Mourinho, who celebrated the goal by walking in front of the rows of Liverpool fans and shushing them.
Very much the end of Mourinho V1, I would say, that day, in the sense that he still had the sort of same hair as he had at Porto. He was sent off. He was in that grey coat, which he used to favour. Sort of came back, I think 05, 06 might have been the first... Carl's the expert here, but the first buzz cut came in at some point. So, yeah, I watched the highlights of that game this week, and it was quite emotional seeing that old Mourinho, really, because it's quite a long time ago.
Scampish Mourinho, some might say. I always describe that era of Mourinho as when he was sort of... He looked quite Peter Falk-esque, baby... Yeah, the baby Columbos.
Yeah.
One more thing.
Yeah, one more thing. Here's a Steven Gerrard on goal.
Yeah, Peter Falk. Who, you know, Princess Bride, if you're not familiar with his work.
I'm fascinated by Carl's cultural hinterland. Like, so Peter Falk and Columbo is fine, but Keith Houchin is a complete mystery. That is...
I was born in the 90s and had a number of childminders that helped me go further, but not further in that way.
But Keith Houchin was not one of those childminders. Fine, I get it. Yeah. That makes sense, yeah.
This time around, it's going to be Tuchel and Klopp on the sideline. Which is exciting because a German manager has never won a domestic cup competition in England. But one of them's going to this Sunday, 4:30. All right. Who's it going to be?
Well, I think it's an interesting game in the sense that you had the new guard of English football, sort of your Man City's and your Chelsea's, have long taken the League Cup and FA Cup particularly seriously because they want trophies because they haven't got as many. And I think it's been a long time coming, but particularly like Liverpool, Man United have not sort of sneered at the Cups, but have taken them less seriously. But I think there's been a real shift in the last couple of years, and suddenly everyone's gone, hang on, it's really good to win trophies. And I think Liverpool fans are suddenly, you know, talking about 2001 again and, you know, wanting to maybe win at least a couple of cups this season. So I think, you know, Liverpool are going to take this quite seriously, and I think it's I fancy them to win.
It seems like everyone's instinct is to think that Liverpool are the team in form. They scored six on Wednesday night. They've closed the gap on Man City to 3 points. They seem to be firing. They've got a fully fit squad. But I'm not quite sure Chelsea's crisis is as bleak as everyone thinks it is. They've won their last five. Their real blip, I think, was in January rather than in February. Obviously, some of the opponents in that run of five games have been Al Hilal and Plymouth Argyle, but they're not woefully out of form. Liverpool probably won't have Jota or Firmino. I think it's really, really finely balanced. And the most important thing, I guess, is that both the league games between the two teams have been really good games, which would be a positive omen for the final.
Yeah, I think people have got a muscle memory of Liverpool-Chelsea from the 2000s when it was just, A, they played 56 times a season, and B, they weren't very good games. You know, hashtag George Vardano. So, as I think if we can get something that's as good as the two league games a season, then we just want a nice Wembley Cup final classic.
Yeah, football to be the real winner in that. Liverpool, as Rory mentions, warming up for the game nicely with a 6-0 thrashing of Leeds. Two for Salah, both from the spot. Two for Mane. John Matip got one. And so did Virgil van Dijk. Crikey.
Apparently.
Yes.
A Liverpool historian says it's the first time two centre-backs have scored in a league game at Anfield for the club since 1968.
Wow. All right.
Been a while.
For Leeds, it's another big defeat. They lost 7-0 at the Etihad in December. And 6-0 this time at Anfield. It means as well that Liverpool are now 3 points back from Man City. I don't know if anyone's mentioned this, but that title race might not be as over as some of us were saying. I did rather double down on my assertion that it was over on Monday. But I might have to concede.
I listened to you kind of equivocating on Monday, James.
And didn't equivocate. And, but that was pretty clear.
I think the problem is that people conflate two things. Ah. So in January, when Manchester City were like 12 or 14 points clear of Chelsea and Liverpool, it did look like the title race was over, that Manchester City were going to win the title. The likelihood remains that Manchester City will win the title, because what Liverpool have to do is extremely unlikely. People sort of say, no, they've got to go to the Etihad on April the 9th, whenever it is, and win, as though that is something that happens all of the time, that people just pitch up at the Etihad and win.
Spurs
Liverpool team. Also have to win a vast majority of their other games, which is also going to be quite difficult. So I think whilst, the predictions that the title race was over were premature, and I made them and hold my hands up to say that I was wrong. The title race is clearly not over. There is a title race. It still remains likelier than not that Manchester City will emerge victorious from that title race.
Although the scary thing for Man City is that Liverpool have hit that streak again. Sasha posting there on either side of a kind of three-game blip around Christmas, they've been absolutely devastating. Six straight wins before Christmas with 17 scored and only two conceded. Post the three-game blip, six straight wins with 18 scored and only two conceded. So, bang in form.
The difficult thing is, Liverpool haven't properly caught Manchester City throughout all of their duels. So 18-19, they were in the race, and they were in the race, and it was a lot to do with games in hand and kickoff times, but they never completely surpassed Manchester City in that title race. City won the title. And then when Liverpool did win the title, that's because they essentially created a fantastic, unassailable lead while City collapsed, and that's what happened. And it is very thrilling to watch Liverpool in the mode of Hunter. I don't think they've successfully caught City in all of these title races that we've talked about, because it very often just becomes that extra inch, that extra little bit that means City eventually triumph. And, I think Sadio Mane, especially when he is in locked in and going, I need to play near perfect to get the results Liverpool want, is one of the most thrilling football players in the world. But we're essentially talking that Liverpool can do this without the body of work to suggest they've done this before.
We'll see what happens. But I mean, I think we can all agree it's a tremendous development. And here comes some numbers from Duncan.
Well, let's not forget the last time Liverpool scored a lot of goals at Palace last season, they then spiralled. It was quite an unusual Liverpool performance, that 6-0 last night, because they don't really... Obviously, Pep Guardiola City do this a lot. You know, you glance up and, oh, look, they've just beaten Norwich or Watford 6 or 7. But that was only the fourth time a Klopp team has scored 6 or more in the Premier League, which made him overtake Sue Ness and Ronald Koeman, which is not the managers you might think. You know, so he's not a sort of like 6 or more quite regular, like Pep's done it 9 times. Alex Ferguson and Wenger obviously lead because of longevity. But so it is interesting to see. I sometimes think Liverpool, when they have a result like this, can kind of make them rest on their laurels a little bit in a way that City don't. But let's, you know, for the sake of the title race, let's hope it that doesn't happen.
You do also have to factor in the Leeds thing, that the results against bad Leeds are not a good guide of where a club is, because we saw this with Everton a few weeks ago, that Leeds pitch up at Goodison Park, it kind of fall apart a little bit, forget to do fairly basic things, and Everton get this really easy win, and suddenly it's, oh, well, Frank Lampard has revitalised Everton, they're going to get in the Champions League, this is the future of, you know, he's going to be the England manager, everything's rosy, and then it turns out actually it's not, because they're still mired in a relegation battle. Leeds do have a habit. I've been at Old Trafford at least twice where Man United have absolutely thumped Leeds, and you look at it and think, right, they're going to catch fire now. This is Man United, this is their modern incarnation. And it's not. It's just that when Leeds go wrong, they go really badly wrong. I think Duncan's probably right. I haven't seen it. I'm not quite sure how he managed to see it, but because it wasn't on television. But I think you have to. Yeah, you just have to kind of factor Leeds in to Leeds losing heavily.
Okay, Duncan doesn't watch television. He watches green vertical streams of numbers permeate his consciousness. So,
that's true.
Yeah. Should we say we're looking forward to Liverpool against Chelsea in the League Cup final this weekend and move on next to the other, perhaps even bigger midweek Premier League story, which was at Turf Moor.
Keep listening for Adrian Clarke versus Benji Laniardo in the Intertoto League Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And it's pre-recorded.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only, get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4+ legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Totally Football Show live is a thing. A listener, and people come along and watch us, I know. But it's going to happen in Manchester on the 19th of April at The Lowry. You can head to thelowry.com for your tickets, if you're quick. On the bill, that man Oily Sailor, Michael Cox, and I can now exclusively reveal Rory Smith of the New York Times. Come on down, Rory.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I love The Lowry. The gallery rather than the hotel. The hotel is... Okay,
good. There you go. 19th of April, you can hear that and more like that from Rory and Coxie and Oily. Now, meantime, also out today in podcast terms is a Football Clichés with me and the Totally Football League Show, not with me, but with Mark Hughes, appointed Bradford manager in League Two, first time he's been a gaffer outside the top flight, and Alexander Mitrovic, perhaps more significantly, scoring his 32nd league goal of the season for Fulham against Peterborough on Wednesday, which means
and
he
33rd.
has... And 33rd, crikey, this just in. And he's now at 33, crikey, which is already more than Ivan Toney did. Go on, Duncan, you explain the significance of this.
Yeah, it's one of those slightly contrived records because they've done it sort of since it became the Championship. But the record was Ivan Toney last season. He's now surpassed that. Obviously, the all-time second-tier record is George Kamsel's 59 the year before Dixie Dean got 60. So I mean, if he gets 50, which is doable, then I think that will be one of the great modern goal scoring seasons, and we can look forward to him maybe hitting 8 or 9 next season.
Very nice. All right. Midweek Premier League. Arsenal and Wolves play Thursday evening. Liverpool beat Leeds 6-0, as we've heard. Also, Watford lost 4-1 to Crystal Palace. And Burnley beat Spurs 1-0. Ben Mee, although that's not the verb I'd choose, what a story this was. Beating Man City and losing to Burnley in the space of 1 week is peak Spurs. And saying, these are the best players I've ever worked with. And then 4 days later, asking, where's the exit? Is peak Antonio Conte. But while Spurs and Conte do them, the bigger story surely is a club that surprises us all by surviving at this level year on, year out, and they're doing their miracle survival bid again. Andy Jones, Athletics correspondent on Burnley, joins us now. Andy, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, what's going on?
Well, wins, pretty much, which is has been a rarity for Burnley this season. One in 21 it was, and now they've got back-to-back wins. And, you know, just the mood in the last, you know, 4 days or 5 days has completely switched from a team who were bottom, and while they were starting to turn performances round and looking better, you know, still hadn't got over the line and in terms of those wins. But a typical Burnley win, I think you'd describe it, against Tottenham, you know, that scrap, that battle, that fight. You know, horrible conditions at Turf Moor, a place you don't want to be at. And they go and get the goal and get the right side of the result, which is something they've struggled to do all season.
There's been much excitement about the arrival of Wout Weghorst. But what was the significance of Ben Mee doing the scoring here?
I mean, you see it in the celebration. He sort of defines everything about Burnley in terms of that attitude, that leadership that he brings. And, you know, he beat the badge as he wheeled away and sort of let out this animalistic roar, if you like, and it was etched across his face. It means everything to these players, and I mean, I spoke to him last month to mark his 10 years at the club, and you know he made it very, very clear that he thought they weren't far away, and that they had the players in place to be able to go and stay up still, and that his sole focus was on making sure that Burnley stay in the Premier League this season, and he epitomises everything good about them, really.
Andy, Burnley have won only 2 of their last 33 Premier League home matches against Big Six oppositions, and both times it was against Spurs. So how much were Tottenham the difference in the performance here and beyond playing Spurs? What has been behind this turnaround?
Well, to come to your second question first, I mean, they basically pressed the reset button after the defeat at Leeds at the start of the year. It was 3-1. It was a game that, you know, they needed to get something out of, and they were just poor, and you know, they got back into it a little bit, but, you know, they were the second best all day. And they hit the reset button, they went back to basics, got the defence right, which was on show at Arsenal when they went there. Didn't really create anything, you know, significant, but got out with a 0-0. And since then has built, and Wout Weghorst has come in and sort of, you know, become a focal point in the attack and made a massive difference. And you can see the players lifting in confidence around that. You mentioned that the home record there, and yeah, generally it's been awful for the last sort of calendar year. I think they'd only won one in the last sort of 12 months, which was at Brentford in October. I mean, it was one of them against Tottenham. It just felt right. But then equally, you know, they've had very good performances against Liverpool, where they were probably unlucky to not come away with anything from that game. They, you know, should have probably taken the lead in the game. And against Manchester United second half, they more than matched them. They've just got that feeling back that the crowd is very much playing its part, and the hostile nature of Turf Moor's returning, which obviously with the pandemic and no crowds, you literally couldn't have that. But, you know, that element of everybody pulling in the same direction, everyone knowing that they can help everyone else, fans can help players can help the fans. You know, it's that togetherness, which is you know, been significant, as well as what they've done behind the scenes and on the pitch.
Well, they're eighth in the form table over the last 6 games. 4 clean sheets in that period. It is kind of every year that Burnley do this, kind of plummet downwards, and then just when people begin to dare to write them off, produce one of their comebacks. But is there a chance with the new backing at the club, with the signings of almost a different kind of player, with, I don't know, Maxwell Cornet and now Weghorst, that we're seeing a shift away from the Burnley that we've been accustomed to?
In a way, but equally that those still, you know, those clear values that Dyche, you know, has always worked under will remain. And you see that. And even the types of players he brought in, I mean, Weghorst, you know, is exactly that type of player. You know, suit barely down to a T in terms of his values, his fitness levels, you know, everything about him. That's his professionalism. That's why he's fitted in so well. But I do. You are right. We are seeing a change. The new owners are open, much more open to exploring the European markets. You know, we've seen that with the signings of Cornet and Weghorst, and you know, they've looked at other players. I think they really like the French market, and I'm sure they'll be exploring that even further, especially with Cornet's initial success. So I think it'll be a bit of a mix and match in terms of we might see a style change a little bit, but then they'll always go back to being that type of team that Dice knows can churn out those results and what they've got back to being good at in the last few weeks.
Andy Jones, Burnley now 18th. 2 points from safety. The team immediately above them are, well, two teams actually, Newcastle and Everton. It's Newcastle who Burnley will be facing on the final day of the season. Gosh. Anyway, well done them. Spurs, though. Here's that Duncan Alexander with a stat. Spurs have now lost as many Premier League games as Burnley this season and let in three more goals.
Someone was like, what's the source? It's like the league table. But I mean, it is interesting with that Burnley because they have drawn a lot of games. Even in their woes, they've obviously been not easy to beat very often. And do you remember when people were poo-pooing the idea that a lot of games in hand isn't good for a season? But we're now seeing the narrative that it injects into a campaign because
Ryan.
It has to, I think it's related to Burnley's upturn in form that they have the two most compelling footballers in the Premier League. There are no players more interesting in English football than Cornet and Weghorst. I could consume Maxwell Cornet and Wout Weghorst content for literally weeks. Just everything, like, what is Maxwell Cornet doing in Burnley? Like, this impish, brilliant, but slightly unpredictable and slightly unreliable player playing for Burnley. And then Weghorst is just this kind of, he's always scored loads of goals, he's enormous, and yet, kind of everything that kind of English football has tried to move away from in a sense. Obviously he's technically very good, but he's the big target man, he's powerful, but we all look like the entire country loves him. People are fascinated by Wout Weghorst. Yeah, he could run for election.
I'd vote for him. I mean,
his name is literally vote.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, is that allowed?
Vote,
I don't know.
Vote, but, vote. But I mean, obviously this game was rearranged because the first time they tried to play it got snowed off and Sean Dyche was parading around in just a shirt. And then if you said to Antonio Conte, right, you've got to come back here in a month or so, but in the meantime Burnley will sign a 6'6" striker and the weather's going to be not quite as bad but still pretty windy and rainy. I mean, no wonder he was sort of trying to resign in the post-match interview.
Was he trying to resign in the post-match interview? I mean, I'm slightly wary of spending a lot of time talking about this because there is a feeling that this is just what Conte does.
Yeah, this is who he's always been. He's always been a character that feels the great rush of victory and then existential lamentations when there's defeat. I'm thoroughly thrilled by both teams reverting to type, pretty much. Burnley have spent several seasons making statistics people look very foolish because they do something when defending that is quite hard to pick up in XG charts and whatnot. So it's very easy to look at the numbers and go, oh, Burnley are terrible. And then Burnley go on a little run. So I think Burnley having games in hand is different from, say, Brighton
Spurs
having games in hand.
Or Spurs having
games in hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, the highly combustible nature of Tottenham Hotspur is you can only really define it within the other highly combustible times of Tottenham Hotspur. So
I think the contrast between the two Spurs performances is what's interesting, that they were brilliant at the Etihad 72 hours before being awful at Turf Moor. And I know what you mean, James, that Conte does this a lot. And from the outside, like his whole last year at Inter seemed to be him saying on a fortnightly basis, I'm going to resign, lads. I'm going to go. You don't want me to go, but I'm going to go. But for a manager to come out and say what he said in the aftermath of that game, I think is significant, and you have to pay heed to it, particularly at a club where I'm guessing Daniel Levy doesn't really want that side of... That's not kind of what Daniel Levy wants from his manager. He doesn't want one defeat and, you know, I need to talk about my position. The players are always the same, but the manager changes.
Given that he's signed Mourinho and Conte as managers, he may need to... revise his recruitment.
He just loves the drama.
Yeah, maybe so, yeah. All right, well, four defeats out of five, as Antonio mentioned, post-game at Turf Moor. And next up, they're facing Leeds on Saturday, which is going to be an interesting game.
That will make them feel better. Yeah, they'll feel a lot better after Leeds.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
What else is coming up this weekend? Let's have a quick romp through the fixtures. Friday, it's Saints Norwich. Saturday, yes, the early game is Leeds against Spurs. 3 o'clock, you got Brentford hosting Newcastle, which is a big game down the bottom now. There's only 2 points between them as well. Crystal Palace are facing Burnley. Brighton get a visit from Villa, and Man United host Watford. The tea time game on Saturday is Everton-Man City. Ooh, could Everton do their Merseyside rivals Liverpool a favour in the title race? Probably not, because they've lost their last 9 games in a row with Man City. But we'll see. Sunday, it's West Ham against Wolves. Oof, what's your pick of that? Do you want to grab a game each that you're most excited about?
I want to take Brentford versus Newcastle, because I think these are two teams in a possible opposite momentum.
Also, it was 3-3 when they faced each other at St James's,
which was fun. And you know, without wanting to evoke Matt Davis Adams too much, I am getting the Matt Davis Adams spider sense when I'm watching this Brentford team going, hang on, are we sure you're safe from the relegation battle?
Well,
do you want to hear my hot take about this? I okay. think the three teams that are going to go down, none of them are currently in the relegation zone.
Oh my word. Ooh. Boom. So you're saying that Watford, Norwich, and who's the other team? Burnley are all going to stay up?
Yeah. And this I think is Leeds, Brentford, and Everton are going down.
Ooh. Duncan, you're not flip reversing now. This is reality we're talking
this
about.
This is, yeah.
Have you got anything, apart from your wish to shock and just be generally controversial, what is behind this assertion?
Well, as Carl was just saying, Brentford are in a spiral. I think, you know, right. you see this quite a lot with teams of their stature that get promoted. It does, you know, start well and then fade. I mean, Everton just look really bad, and all their numbers are really bad. And then Leeds, as we were saying earlier, they can't defend, and they're conceding a load of goals. Now, obviously, Watford aren't in great form, but I think it's easy to look at the midweek defeat to Palace and go, well, they were terrible, but they weren't that bad. Palace scored 4 goals from an XG of 0.7, so that was pretty unlikely in itself. Hodgson will keep them picking up points. Norwich, not great, but they're better under Smith, and we all know about Burnley. Burnley are going to finish top half, so yeah, it's on.
They are. I think I can see a case in which Burnley and Watford just about get out of it. Norwich, I think it's harder to see surviving, and I'm not sure. I think Everton probably will pull themselves away a little bit. I worry a lot about Leeds, largely from a geographic proximity point of view. It's quite nice being within an hour of a Premier League stadium, and it would be less than ideal for me personally if they were relegated.
Everton, who are level with Newcastle, if Newcastle beat Brentford, which you can imagine happening, and if Burnley win their game against Palace, Everton are going to be at home to Man City. They could well be in the bottom three by Saturday night.
And this is what makes that game interesting, and it's what we kind of forget a little bit when you look at the end of the season, is that there comes a point where the teams who are rubbish are not the ones you want to face, because they are fighting for something. So it might still be a little bit early. It's still only February, but you don't want to be playing Norwich away. You want to play Norwich away in October. If you're trying to win the title, you don't want to play Norwich away in early May. Just at that point, there is that just slight randomness of they're desperate and they might just be able to lift themselves. And I think Everton Man City is much more of a banana skin for City than it should be, because Everton will be starting to feel the pressure.
Okay.
I mean, City will still win 5-0, but, you know, in theory.
Right. It's a lovely thought. Okay, Everton have won both their home games under Frank Lampard, former City player, of course, by 3 goals. So there's that. Leeds, Tottenham, we mentioned. West Ham, Wolves is a bit of a six-pointer in the top four race. It was a 1-0 win at Molineux for Wolves. Raul Jimenez. The Clarets, Burnley, will be away at Palace. That was also a 3-3 back in November. More of that, please. And Palace looking good. Well, 4-1 against Watford and their former manager, Roy Hodgson, midweek. Duncan, we never got your fixture that you're excited about.
Probably West Ham Wolves, okay. I would say, just because it's a clash of approaches. You know, West Ham, they've scored and conceded in 17 different Premier League games this season, which is the most of any team. So, you know, goals at both ends, maybe not necessarily what you think from a David Moyes team, whereas obviously Wolves are very much the reverse, who are, you know, looking to get in the top four with not many goals. So I think Wolves seem to be the team that are improving or coming good most at the moment. Obviously, Pedro Neto's just got back from long-term injury, which I think is a big, you know, hashtag like a new signing. Whoever wins this game can really probably say, look, we have actually got a chance of getting in the top four, given the inconsistency amongst the other big teams going for it. I know Arsenal have got probably in the best position in terms of games in hand and stuff, but it would be lovely to see one of these two get into the top four. And it'd be interesting to see who comes out with 3 points if it's not a draw.
This set of fixtures is the reverse of the games back in November, which saw both Dean Smith and Steven Gerrard debut with new clubs. They both won their first game in charge. How long ago that seems. Southampton were the visitors for Norwich for Dean Smith's first game in charge. It was Villa at home to Brighton. The reverses take Villa down to the Amex. Ooh, producer Charlie just mentioning that Eddie Howe's first game in charge was going to be at home to Brentford, but of course he had the COVID, so he had to sit that one out. But, you know, he was officially signed up. But yeah, Steven Gerrard and Aston Villa at Brighton, they've only had one win in the last 8 games now. Crikey. And for that matter, Norwich, although they've had 2 defeats in a row, but before that they had a 4-game unbeaten run. Crikey.
That's the thing with Norwich. They've just lost to City and Liverpool, which can happen to the best of us. They're at Southampton on Friday night. Carl knows what happens to Southampton on Friday nights. They lose 9-0. So,
mate, don't bring it up again.
It's funny that Villa have suddenly collapsed in form as well, because I think that runs totally contrary to the perception of how Gerrard's doing at Villa. This is something I once said to Chris Sutton, and he was scornful of the logic.
Did he call you a caveman?
He didn't call me a caveman. He just sort of laughed in my face, and which he does a lot, and told me it was nonsense. But I'm really interested in how general perception of a team is forged by its results when its games are on television. Mm. Yes. And I think it's a massive factor in how we think teams are doing. So I'm guessing if you went to most fans and said, hey, Villa have won 1 in 8, people would be going, no, they haven't. They're good. Gerrard's got them playing really, really well. And it's because they've had a couple of big games in which they've played well on TV.
Yep.
And one reason why the 9-0 defeat for Southampton was so shocking was because it was one of the handful of games Southampton are on television.
As was their 9-0 at United, right?
Quite. Stop. I don't know why I'm talking about Southampton. I think with Aston Villa, one big thing is the way they're playing right now is simply ask John McGinn to do too much defending. The whole point of Villa and the Gerrard is they're trying to play in this narrow 4-3-3. But while Coutinho is a joy to watch when he's enjoying football, he's not the most diligent defender anymore. And it does leave quite a little bit of space in central midfield where Villa are a little bit threadbare. McGinn, I'm a big fan of. I think he's one of the Premier League football players I watch and go, you could improve 20 to 35% if someone just took you away from the football on the training ground and go, this is how you run in a more economical style.
Okay.
But I think he's being stretched much too thin in this Villa team right now.
Am I going to be seeing long reads about how Coutinho is Villa's Asprilla?
What, ends the season with more assists than any other player in the league since his signing? Possibly, because he is doing quite well at the moment. But, yeah, I mean, since him and Luca Dean made their debuts, Coutinho's had the most shots, Dean has created the most chances, which you do, with a manager as iconic and, I guess, influential as Gerrard, you do wonder whether he'll get to the summer and go, all right, lads, my signings work, give me loads more signings, which might not necessarily be economical for Villa. But, I mean, they're far enough up that they should be fine. They're not in my vortex of relegation doom, but it's quite an intriguing game, this one, because Brighton aren't in great form either. You know, they've only scored 10 goals in 12 Premier League home games this season. The old, remember back in sort of September, October, we were like, yep, Graham Potter's cracked it, he's broken XG, Brighton are going to be the new whatever. Yeah,
but before they lost to Man United and the resurgent Burnley, they were on their longest undefeated run in Premier League history.
Yeah, but they just draw all the time. They're, you know...
That was true in that first spell as well, when the Duncan mentions when Potter was being, and this is, I think Graham Potter's a great manager, I'm not criticising him, but there was a sense that he was doing brilliantly, and you looked at the results and Brighton hadn't won in 10 and they'd drawn 8 games.
We're going to round up what happens in all of these matches on Monday. Loads of things to look forward to. We haven't finished with today's show though, by a long shot, because next up we're going to conclude with Inter Totally Cup Match 3, Benji against Adrian. So far, listener, our opening matches have seen Duncan Alexander are putting Alvaro Romeo into his misery with a 4-0 defeat, and then Dom Fifield defeating Tom Williams 4-1. Next up, two more contestants. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook
while my DJ revolves it. Up first, he's a West Ham fan who made it all the way to last year's final without kicking a single cat en route. He's the acceptable face of the East End. He is Benji Lanyardo.
Yep, he's the man who froze out the competition all the way to the final last year, Benji Lanyardo.
Hey, Jimbo.
Good to have you back, Benji. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been good. I mean, I think it was the absolute peak of my football trivia powers last year. I've had a kid since. And I think that all that space in my brain that was taken up with football trivia has been replaced with, frankly, much more useful information since then. So, I'm just here to enjoy myself, Jimbo.
All right. Well, you enjoyed your way all the way to the final match last time round. Let's see if you can get past round one this time as we introduce your opponent.
And his opponent, he's a former Gooner who's also played for Rotherham, Southend twice, Carlisle once, Stevenage, Hendon, Margate and Welling United. And that's all we've got time for in this intro. It's Adrian Clark.
How long will this last? Adrian, a man whose career is built on quality and quantity, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, how long will it last? Probably not that long. But yeah, we're here to have a bit of fun, aren't we? I've not been very good on the Totally Football League Show quizzes this season. And normally the specialist subject is my own career, and I've struggled on that. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping, you know, questions on other people might help me today.
Adrian, you went crashing out in the opening round of last year's competition. Have you been doing since? Have you had any children or anything?
No, but I do have three. So yeah, I don't have a lot of room in there. Right. But no, I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, it was a tough draw. I lost 4-3, I think, to Duncan Alexander last year. No shame in that. But no, yeah, I'm just hoping to avoid the duck this year.
Well, indeed. All right. Well, Adrian's leading 3-1 on the children count, but let's see how he does on the questions. I should just mention the winner, of course, progresses straight to the quarterfinals and will receive £10 for the charity of their choice. Paddy Power will also place that sum on the bet of your choice, with the winnings also going to charity. So what will your charity be? Benji, what's your charity of choice?
It's a company called Well Grounded. They help people from underprivileged backgrounds. They train them for jobs in the specialty coffee industry. Really, really cool company.
Tremendous. And what is your wager going to be?
It's Craig Dawson to score any time this weekend, which would make it 3-3 for him.
Ooh, all right. Adrian, your charity of choice?
Muscular dystrophy research for me, please, this year.
Okay. And your bet?
Oh, my bet is Sadio Mane to score any time in the Carabao Cup final.
Brilliant. Carabao Cup final. Nice. Okay, well, it's the Inter Totally Cup first round now. And first up, it's Adrian. Adrian, here come your questions. Question one. Who was the last club outside of Juventus, Milan and Inter to win Serie A?
Juventus, Milan and Inter. Okay. Not my specialist area, Italian football, it has to be said. I'm going to go for, and it is a guess, I'm going to go for Roma.
Is correct. Fabio Capello's Roma in 2001. You're on the board. Question two. When Fabio Capello resigned as England manager in 2012, who took over as caretaker for one game against the Netherlands?
Ooh, 2012. That is a good question. Fabio Capello. Came in. Oh, dear. That is tough.
Gonna have to hurry you, Adrian.
I don't think. I know this.
From Fabio Capello, one game against the Netherlands.
I've got nothing. No.
Right. Did you know this, Benji?
It was Stuart Pearce, maybe.
It was Stuart Pearce, maybe. Yeah. All right. No points for that, but you know, maybe a slight psychological advantage as we ask Adrian. Question three: for which Turkish Super League club does Mario Balotelli currently play?
Oh, dear, oh, dear. These overseas questions killing me. Let me think. Balotelli. Has he joined Galatasaray, Trabzonspor, Istanbul, Başakşehir?
Adrian?
I'm going to go for Istanbul, Başakşehir.
Well, I'm afraid it's Adana Demirspor.
Never going
to
get that.
Way over to the east on the border with Syria, I believe, excitingly. Okay, question four. What is the name of the trophy awarded by France Football at the same time as the Ballon d'Or, which goes to the best goalkeeper of that year?
Some kind of golden glove, surely, but I don't know. I suspect that's not the name of the trophy.
Are you going with golden gloves?
Yeah, let's go with that.
It's incorrect. It's the Yashin Trophy.
Yeah.
Named after, of course, Lev
Yashin.
You may
have known that.
Question five, then, with a chance here to double your score. Who recently took charge of his first game as Shelbourne manager in the League of Ireland?
Oh, dear. Nothing on English football. This is apart from Stuart Pearce. This is harsh. Shelbourne. Don't know. Don't follow Irish football. This one's passed me by.
Right. Benji, do you know?
Pass.
Shelbourne. I'll take a punt. Damien Duff.
Oh, my word. That's extraordinary. Once again, your intuition has proved correct. It is Damien Duff. Giving you a score of 2 out of 5.
I have to say, that is the flukiest guess in the history of the Intertotally. So,
we'll see, because Benji's about to come. So, but 2 out of 5, how do you feel about that scoreline?
Disappointed. Yeah, I got a 3 last year. I feel that was quite a tough set of questions, but disappointed.
All right. Well, we'll see. 2 out of 5 would have been enough to beat 2 of our contestants in the opening game so far. So, Benji Lagnado, if you're ready, let's go with your first question. Question one. Who was the last club outside of Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid and Barcelona to win La Liga?
I think it's probably Rafa's Valencia, but there was a Deportivo, that was quite long ago. I'll say Valencia.
Is correct. All right then, question two. Between Kevin Keegan resigning and Sven-Göran Eriksson taking over as England manager, two men had one-game caretaker spells. Who were they?
That was sort of the era of Peter Taylor. I'll say Peter Taylor.
That's one of them, Benji.
Think I know it.
Oh, Wilkinson.
Is correct. Is correct. Oof.
Yeah. That was right out of the...
of pre-baby brain.
I'm amazed that has remained in my head.
Yeah. So two for two, and here comes question three. For which Turkish Super League club, does Ryan Babel currently play?
Feels quite Istanbul, Basaksehir-y. He feels like one of those. But, I'm just going to say that then.
Basaksehir is incorrect. Yeah. Galatasaray is the current home club of Ryan Babel, which means you're still level with Adrian Clark as we move to question four. What is the name of the award given to the man of the match in the League Cup final?
Is it the Callum McManaman Remembrance Certificate?
It's not, Benji. It's not, of course. It's the Alan Hardacre Trophy.
That's right. Obviously.
Who was Alan Hardacre for a bonus point?
Imagine he was man of the match in a League Cup final once.
Maybe the first one or something. That's extraordinary.
Maybe.
Okay, question five then. Which Scottish Premiership club was Sean Maloney recently appointed manager of?
Maloney, he was hanging out with Martinez in Belgium, wasn't he? What is there any Belgian connections in Scotland? I don't know the answer to this, but I'm gonna guess Hibs.
So you're attempting a Adrian Clark-esque last minute Hail Mary 3-pointer from the other end of the court by just shouting out Hibs.
Yeah.
Benji, the answer is Hibernian. He's done it. He's only
lucky.
Pulled it out.
I think Maloney. Did Maloney play for them? That's the only reason that it might have connected in my head. Sorry, Adrian. That feels a bit fluky.
That was a tough set of questions, I have to say, for both of you. But 3-2 in the circumstances, very respectable scores. However much guesswork was involved in the achieving of them, Adrian, you leave us then in quiz sense for another year. But how do you feel?
Yeah, I feel a little bit deflated, but I can live with it. It's fine. I lost to the better man on the day.
Wow, it was an extraordinary final answer that from Benji Laniado, who, as his reward, will be meeting in the quarterfinals either Matt Davis-Adams or Julien Laurens. Benji, who do you fancy?
Well, I knocked out Julien last year, so I imagine he'll be chomping at the bit for revenge. So I'll go for I'd like a bit of Matt action this time around, thanks.
Oh, you'll smash Matt. It's an easy one, Matt.
We'll see. We've got more action from the Intertotally coming up every Monday and Thursday, so we'll find out your opponents soon enough. But Benji, massive congratulations, particularly on that Hail Mary effort on the final question, and we look forward to seeing you in the quarterfinals.
See you, Jimbo. Thank you.
Mazel tov, Benji. You're through to the next round of the Intertotally Cup. And if you concur with Benji's bet that Craig Dawson will score any time against Wolves, it's priced at 15-2 at paddypower.com or on the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. And please, gamble responsibly.
Cracker, well, that was dramatic. And well done to former finalist Benji Laniado. What did you think of that, Rory?
Which side? I don't know when I'm up, actually, to be fair. Which side of the draw is Benji on? Is he on the side of the draw that I'll get knocked out by Lindsay in?
So you're up against Lindsay Hooper next, and you're on the other side of the draw to Benji Laniado. However, you're on the same side of the draw as one Michael Cox. And to be fair, Daniel Story.
Mm. Yeah, and it, obviously, if I mean, I'm not going to go through, because my record in the Inter totally is appalling.
Oh yeah,
it's it's kind of it's Leeds United in cup competitions bad, so it's not really relevant. But obviously, if I do make it through somehow, if Lindsay has to kind of, if maybe there's some sort of scandal and she's thrown out for doping, then and I do go on to face Michael then and lose, then obviously I will not be doing Totally Live in April.
Well, oh, really?
Is it you first?
It's me next, and then
oh, I don't mind.
Michael.
I don't mind.
So you could be sat on that panel having knocked out me and Michael.
I cannot stress enough that I will not get through against Lindsay. But if I lose to you, that's fine. I'm just not losing to Toxie.
Mind games.
I might throw it.
Right. Well, there you go. We've got more Inter Totally coming up on Monday, along with all the other stuff in the show. For now, though, it's many thanks to Carl, Duncan and Rory, and you, listener, and producer Charlie. Have a great weekend where possible, and we'll be back with you after that. Ciao.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.